It went off like a bang. Oh, everything, it changed in that moment. It went off like a bang.
So you stayed the first night at Dave and Allie's?
Yes. I didn't really sleep. I tossed and turned a lot. Woke up and, you know, I mean, woke up from not sleeping, if that makes sense. And basically just waited for it to be late enough for me to make some calls. And I wanted to call my in-laws and my brother-in-law and his wife, who I love very much, and just let them know that we were separating. And I just shared the specific factual things that he had told me in his confession. I didn't speculate or exaggerate. It just was very true to what he repeated to me.
Can I ask what that was?
You know, just that he had been with other women over the last few years. It's like a good general way to say it. And I remember feeling kind of bad because, you know, it was about 7 a.m. my time. And I called his parents. His parents knew that we were trying to have a baby. And it didn't dawn on me till after I hung up the phone that I bet they were thinking I was calling that early. And the first thing I said is, are you guys sitting down? And they said yes. And then I think my mother-in-law heard how upset I was and was like, are you okay? You know, what's wrong? And I just kind of tearfully told them what I had learned the night before and let them know that we were going to be separating and told them I loved them very much. I probably wouldn't be communicating with them very much in this time, not because I was angry with them, but because I just felt like they're his family and he would need them and I have plenty of support. And I just needed them to hear it from me.
What were the responses?
His parents were grief-stricken, is a great way to say it. I can't remember if it was my father-in-law or my mother-in-law right now, but one of them kept saying, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I can't believe this. I'm so sorry. It's shocking. You know, it was shocking for me for like the first few months. So it's shocking for the community. I think that, you know, about the 8 or 9 of us that gathered at Dave and Allie's that first night, I mean, people were stunned and everyone cried. It's not just a betrayal for me, it's a betrayal for the community. And it's not even about, you know, sex or affairs. I think there's something to just the line that is really hard to swallow. It's like it can't compute. You're trying to put this new information in the framework of the whole past relationship, and you start wondering what was honest and what was dishonest. And obviously as an adult, you know that not everything was dishonest and not everything was a lie. I mean, that's not even possible. But it's hard to catalog every memory and start to wonder where was the line between honesty and dishonesty. Like, do I believe that we had wonderful moments in our marriage? Absolutely. And do I believe those were genuine? Absolutely. It wasn't the whole marriage that was happening, you know? Were there moments like in the unfaithfulness that we're still good? I think that that's true. I just think the human experience is more complex and is not binary. But it's just impossible to not just, it's like I had a Rolodex flipping in my brain of every memory. And then there were things that I remember at the time, like felt peculiar, but they weren't red flags, right? And I think those peculiar times definitely floated to the surface. And then you start to ask yourself the questions of like, was that a time that this happened? You know? So yeah, like with this song, this was in the summer, you know, after I had kind of gotten back in the studio and wrote that last section of Ring of Fire, I started to write over the summer. And, you know, one of the really hard realities of separation without children, and I can't speak to what it would be like with children. I'm sure that's a whole nother complexity that's really challenging. I know it is for the friends I have, but not for my own experience, is that my house was very alone. It was very quiet. Like one of the things I would say to my friends I started to notice when I go over and hang out, because most of my friends have kids and they're lovely, I love them all very much, is that their house is always filled with noise and sound. There's always some sort of life source in the house, sighing or laughing or crying or shouting or doing something. And I just felt like, oh man, my house is like so effing quiet. I could hear a pin drop all the time, unless I'm making noise in it. And you start to realize that like noises are signs of life. And I realized how alone I felt. And not alone in the sense where I don't have community. I'm really rich with community. I'm grateful for that. But I'm still going to bed and waking up every day by myself. And to be really honest, and this speaks to the people in my life, I didn't sleep one night alone by myself the first 30 days. People flew out for basically the first 2 weeks. My friend drove out from LA who I'd been visiting prior and spent a week with me. My sister came out. My friend Sarah came out. My friend Ann came out. Then people were taking shifts. My friend Michelle, who's a close friend of mine here, who's a teacher, would sleep here every night that somebody wasn't in town, you know, to be here with me.
Oh, like I've never in my life experienced anything so heavy. Like I use words like grief and pain, but they don't even feel big enough to describe like the emotions that she had or what she was feeling and just like the deep, dark place that she was in. Like, I don't think I've ever walked through something like that with a friend until this happened to Tifa. Like sometimes there just aren't words. Like you're there and you're walking alongside of somebody and you're in it with them, but you don't have the words. It's just like your presence is like a comfort and just to know that you're not alone. And I think that's what she really needed in that time. And I know she had a close friend, Sarah, like she was there like shortly after it happened. I think she flew in.
So I flew up on Friday morning because I didn't want Latifah to be by herself. Not that she's by herself. She has amazing community in Colorado. But she's in this house where their whole life was together. And I mean, I think when she picked me up, her eyes were puffy from crying. And I think that was kind of the constant state she'd been in since she'd found out. And I think that whole weekend, and for a long time after, for a few months after still, it just felt like this constant recalibrating of reality, of remembering that it happened, re-experiencing that disbelief again, realizing what that meant for reality, and then realizing like everything felt destroyed.
I just felt it. I don't know what it was. I was freaked. It was such a night and day transition.
It's interesting to me, sort of the metaphor in the song, there's this amazing double entendre that we'll get into, but like, you know, you're talking about it as though it's the bang is this like gunshot going off. And I'm thinking about that like deafening, disorienting moment after you hear a gunshot go off. And that's kind of what this sounds like. It's the quiet and it's the complete disorientation.
Yeah. Like in movies, you know, when people shoot guns off and they try to emulate it, it's like their ears are ringing and like they can't really hear anything and their head's spinning. It's kind of like that for sure. And I remember my friend who had gone through a divorce a year or two prior to me came that first week, and I was at Dave and Allie's, and I had asked her about just what were the next steps? What do? How do you survive? And she has two kids and she is a strong, amazing woman. And she's a nurse, and she sat me down and I told her, and as I was telling her, like, I'll never forget, like, as I'm telling her what's happening, I mean, she walked in the door, had no idea what had happened yet in my life, sat down across from me, held my hands, and tears just streamed down her face. And I think that's even why I get emotional now. And when I hear somebody else's story who's similar, is that you're able to go back to that moment, that disorienting, horrifying, painful moment when your whole life changed in 1 second. And she looked at me and she said, Tifa, like right now you're in the ER. You are bleeding out. You've had a traumatic accident, and everyone, your community, everybody's got hands on you and they're trying to like repair wounds and get you what you need. And you're just going to be here for a while. And then after this, you're going to be in the ICU. And then when you're not in the ICU any longer, you're going to go to like a room. And then one day you'll leave the hospital, you know? And she told me, she was like, you know, I know it's hard to hear this now, but when she was saying it, I just believed her, is that she's like, right now you're trying to figure out how to survive, but one day, like, you're actually going to thrive. But she's like, you're just not there yet. And so just be in the ER and like, let your community come around you, let your community take care of you, because like you're bleeding out. And it was helpful language for me in the moment.
It's interesting in the context of the song too. I mean, like,
yeah,
you weren't just near a loud, disorienting, deafening sound.
Yeah.
You were on the receiving end.
Yeah.
Blood coursed through my veins. Oh, oh, when those fatal words were spoken, that I was not your chosen, it went off like a bang.
Yes, I wrote that really late at night. I think it was like after 11. I was in my pajamas and I actually Instagram videoed. I wrote it and I knew it was special. And actually the first verse I wrote was the second verse. The how do you explain what it feels like to lose the one you love, you know? Because I remember I was sitting down to write about it and I thought, where do you even start with something like this? Like, it's so huge. And what are the words that even feel appropriate? And so that's actually the first sentence that came out was, how do you explain what it feels like to lose? And then the gun metaphor came to my mind, and I wrote the first two thirds of that song pretty quickly.
How do you explain what it feels like to lose? How do you explain what it feels like? Lose the one you love. Oh, oh, oh. When no words can be spoken to fix what's been broken, how do you explain?
The way that the strings and stuff sound in that song specifically,
yeah,
it feels so perfectly vintage.
I've got to credit that to Dave. Yeah. Besides the strings that Keith and Cameron played on, I'd programmed the strings for the whole record except for this song. Dave really wanted to take a crack at it, and he nailed it. He mixed the record as well, and he's so talented. I mean, I can't speak highly enough about him, but partnering with him is just so easy, you know? We kind of finish each other's musical sentences. It's like he read the map in my brain, which was amazing. But he even like reamped the strings through a programming thing that was amazing, and then opens them up off the amp plugin, you know, at the end so they feel wider. And it's just so vibey. And this is the only song too where the Moog sub fatty isn't the only bass instrument. The bass that's plucky isn't even a bass. This is an SG guitar that Dave performed like a bass. I knew I wanted kind of this old plank, you know, it's got this,
it's
old,
like a 50s doo-wop.
Yeah, yeah, totally, man.
What made you want to do that?
When I originally wrote it, I had the piano on the felt piano setting. So it was just this clunky bunk, gunk, 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 bunk, gunk, gunk. When I started writing it, and just the vocal melody feels old.
I was about to say, the melody just lends itself to
exactly
that sound.
Exactly, it demands
like,
yeah, it.
But then there's like a, you know, when it starts to build, which I find really cathartic. A lot of the song, it's like 50s doo-wop-y
right
vibe. And then it's like, all of a sudden there's like drum fills that are like,
bunka, bunka,
yeah, bunka, it feels bunka, a little, yeah, less like vintage and more like current. Yeah. You know what I mean? And it does have a cathartic, like this build that's just like, I feel like if it were me singing it, like I would just be like yelling it. Do you, yeah, know what I mean?
Do you, yeah, want to show us with that?
No, I'd rather not. But
not to even mention how great the drums sound on that song.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the tone of those drums is fantastic. But
yeah,
I love that. You have this like really recognizable song to start out the record. And even that is like surprising at the end. You're like surprised by this. Whoa, what is this? And mm-hmm, then the second track is very recognizable in that it's like 50s doo-wop,
yeah,
vibe telling this heavy story. But also it still has this recognizable thing to it. It's,
yeah,
like really cool.
I like writing songs that feel familiar, even if they're new. I think that's one, yeah, of the things that get new listeners right away. Having a familiar feel. When I first wrote it in the summer, I wasn't totally thinking about record order. I was just thinking about emoting. And then, you know, as I get closer to actually crafting the record, I start thinking about order, and I'm thinking about telling this story through the record. I wanted to take people on the sequential emotional arc. And so I felt like Bang would be a good second track, and I hadn't finished the song yet. I mean, even doing this podcast, I struggle with telling people the reality of the story. I don't know how to. My heart is not to slander Reed or vilify Reed. I mean, but there are like facts in the story that help explain the reality of what has happened. And so I knew there was a place in the record where I would need to reveal in certain ways, like what had happened. But I didn't know how to do that in a way that felt still respectful, but honest, or, you know, if that makes any sense. It's kind of an odd juxtaposition to be in as a human when you want to be honest, but you're also not interested in just throwing somebody under the bus.
So we're getting to the double entendre.
Yeah. And it's just, it's so clever. But
it's so clever.
Yeah. So I knew initially that How Do You Explain needed to be verse two, even though I wrote that first. And so I knew I was starting off the song. It went off like a bang. And I had a friend of mine say, oh, you really need to call the song How Do You Explain? And I was like, no, man, the song title's bang out the gate for sure. So I'm staring at the record order, the songs I have. I'm kind of crafting it in order to like show Dave what I've got. And I'm staring at the album title and I'm like, well, that's kind of revealing itself. And so I started thinking about the gun metaphor, but then also just the term bang can be used in a different way. So it's a double meaning. It's the actual idea of like, you told me this thing, like you pointed this gun emotionally at me and shot it, but you also did the action, which is bang.
You pulled the trigger.
Subtle, which I appreciate. So like a few of my friends that listened to it didn't catch it.
I didn't catch it.
Until right now?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's my way of revealing without just being pretty literal. But like there's only two sentences in the whole album and this is one of them.
So I want to really dig into this.
Yeah.
First of all, I didn't realize until I was hearing you talk about it just now, I've never thought of it as the second song on the record. I've known the track order. But I think of it as the first song on the record, and I think of Ring of Fire as the prelude. That wasn't a conscious thought, but that was like, yeah. It's like, oh, wow, this isn't how the record opens, and that's not just an intro to this song.
Yeah. It's kind of how a book would be written about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the double entendre, I think it's brilliant, and here's why. That terminology, when used the way that you're using it, does not describe intimacy. It does not describe love.
That's not what it was.
It's cheap, and it's brief and it's fleeting. And I just think that's what's so brilliant. This isn't talking about even like an affair. This is talking about you traded something wonderful for something very cheap, very worthless.
Yeah.
I think that's brilliant.
Thanks.
Even just the brevity of that sound of a bang. I mean, it's a thing that happens and it changes everything, but it's fast and it's quick and it's not a lingering moment, but it lingers forever. Yeah. And so I don't know how much of that you were thinking about as you wrote it, but I love that you used such a crude kind of vulgar term. Yeah.
That's how it feels though.
Yeah, exactly.
That, I mean, feels appropriate. And I mean, just to humanize for a second, like we all trade things, whether they're big or small, for things that are fleeting, that actually do not serve us and hurt us in the end. It could be as simple as like eating something really horrible and crappy for your body that feels really good as you're eating it, even though you know it's going to make you feel sick 10 minutes later. To blowing up a relationship. I feel like it's important for me to say that because we all do it. We all do it to different extremes. We all make different choices, and some choices are better than others. But that is a human reality, and it's inescapable.
Yeah.
So when you say that, when you think of the moment that it went off for you, what's the moment in your head that you picture?
I picture sitting across from him and him telling me, the first sentence that came out of his mouth, which was the first part of the confession. Hmm. It's not even finding the box in the trash can.
That's interesting, because that's the moment I imagine.
I picture the door immediately.
That's interesting.
And I mean, obviously, this is not my story. I just think it's interesting to think about.
Well, to be honest, because until he actually spoke the words, ultimately, what I really have is well-supported speculation.
Yeah.
And there's something about the act of confession, which is legitimizing and important and necessary, even for the process to start healing. You don't really think in that moment that you're starting to heal. It was a year and a week ago that I found out. And in that moment, I would never have said that that's when healing started to begin. But I think I could say that now.
That's the moment that you felt the bang, though.
I know.
That's what's crazy.
But that's the trauma.
Right.
Like, the trauma has to come first.
Right.
And then, like, there's, like, minute, minuscule work being done that you cannot feel or understand. Uh-huh. But healing is slow and painful and, I feel impatient with it even when I talk about it. But I needed him to say it to start moving forward, even though it felt like the world stopped, if that makes any sense. I know it's an odd way to frame it, but he had to say it. And I'm grateful he did. I want to say that. That could not have been easy. Speculation and wondering and the waiting of not knowing is a horrible limbo to live in. So yeah, it was a bang. It was shocking. It was when trauma happened, but I was headed down that way, I guess, before he said it. But yeah, that's the moment I think about, is when he actually said the first sentence in our living room.
I don't want to get too far ahead, but like, when did the deafening, disorienting ringing in your ears stop?
Maybe around 6 months.
Really?
4 to 6 months, feels honest. And it's like, it starts to wane, right? But you said stop. So I would say I stopped having moments of feeling shocked 6 months out.
So what was your next step?
So I came back to the house. I had people staying with me for about the first week and a half. I had only brought the people in besides my immediate family, Reed's immediate family, and the people that were Dave and Allie's house. Those are the only people that knew. I held it really close. It's this weird thing when you're grieving and you live in community and you want to be true to that experience, but you also know that your experience isn't for everyone. I knew in that moment I didn't necessarily want to draw 50 people into my experience, right? But I knew I would need more than the 8 people that I had initially long term. So there becomes a reality of a responsibility, in my opinion, to let your community know in order to have self-care later on. Because people need to feel bought in. They need to feel like they're with you, and they need to feel like they weren't forgotten. And it's a weird dynamic of thinking for yourself while also thinking about others, so you can think about how they can also care for you because you're in need, if that makes any sense. So I crafted an email that I sent to a handful of people, some out of state, people that I felt emotionally connected to, people that I felt like were safe, people that I felt like wouldn't honestly just throw Reed under the bus and vilify him, but like have compassion that we're both human beings in a horrible situation. But also like people that I could call in the middle of the night if I needed them. And I'm really fortunate in that I have made a lot of deep connections with a lot of lovely people. So I sent that email out. The email basically stated that Reed had been unfaithful. We were separated. I didn't know quite at the time what I was doing, but I am grieving. And I just asked for support, asked for prayers, asked for all those things. And one friend who I love very much, he was the only one that wrote back in all caps, "Congratulations, you're about to start the rest of your life." And I remember feeling like kind of horrified initially by that email. I laughed because I know him very well. And I know what he's really saying is like, you're going to be okay. Everybody else was pretty horrified. But the title is Hard News. So my friend that wrote back congratulations in all caps, just for some context. So I have a like 99% chance benign tumor in the middle of my brain, which he knows. When he got that email, he was in a session and thought, oh, F, like Tifa's brain tumor is cancerous and she's dying. So that was his thought in the whole session before he could get out and read the email. So when he read the email, he said he started laughing and thought, oh, she's just, you know, her marriage is just ending.
Oh my goodness.
So in his mind, it was like, she's not dying.
Instead, your life is starting.
Yeah, exactly. So I knew long term I would need some serious support, and I knew I'd have to bring people in order for that to happen. As scary as that felt. Not because people were unsafe, but because it's just kind of humiliating to share that your marriage is failing and or has failed. It dings my pride. And I also didn't want to like fill everybody in with salacious details, just like I'm trying not to do right now. And there's a part of you that like wants to defend yourself and just get everything out so people can know everything. And then there's a reality of it's just not necessary. So I'm still trying to navigate sometimes like what's respectful to share. But yeah, people have been really kind and supportive.
So we're recording this in your house.
Yeah.
This is my second time here. My first time was 4 years ago on tour, stayed here with you and Reed. Mm-hmm. And this is my first time here where this feels like a haunted house. That may be weird for me to say. But I, as you're telling the story, I'm like picturing you in every moment. And it's like fucking hard, man. Like, I don't like thinking about you standing at that doorway with this rope pulling you outside.
Yeah,
I don't like thinking about you coming to this trash can. And I remember like getting this email. I was like standing in my kitchen. I think I was home by myself and I saw the subject line and was like, oh shit, you know.
She's dying from brain tumor.
Yeah. And so I opened it and was just, I mean, it was like, you know, it was a shock. I could never have guessed that that's what this was. You know, and I called my wife immediately, you know. And I think I waited a couple of days to call you because I knew you probably were being bombarded. And honestly, I feel like I failed as a friend in this time because I know
you didn't.
I didn't know what to do from so far away and in my situation and whatever was going on. But all that to say, like I'm playing all this out as you're telling the story, and you know we're talking about when you picture the bang, what you picture, and my mind is going crazy thinking about all of this and how hard it must be for you to like be here in the place where all this happens so quickly.
Yeah.
And devastatingly. And it's hard for me to like sit here and hear it and like just picture it all happening, playing out in front of me in this place that feels haunted.
Yeah. I'd had a few people ask me that right away. This is my home.
Yeah.
This is where I've made every Page Six VI album, where I've made Autumn Film Records and Motor Records and other friends' records, and where I've hosted almost everybody that I love deeply.
Yeah.
Like, this is a place rich with like wonderful memories.
Yeah.
And so I don't feel robbed of my home. I feel robbed of having a family.
Yeah.
That's where I get stuck still sometimes. But I totally empathize and understand how that's your experience or how it's my mom's experience when she first came back after knowing to the house or for friends. And it was an adjustment, but this is my home.
Yeah.
And that hasn't been taken away, which I'm glad for. But yeah, sometimes I stare at that trash can because that's the trash can. It's like a nice trash can. Like I can't really afford to replace it.
You don't need, it's a good trash can.
And I just, sometimes my buddy Aaron was emptying my trash out for me last week because I had tweaked my back a little, and he opened it and took it out. And I was thinking, is there going to be a day where I don't open that trash can and think, what happened? And maybe there's days where I open it, don't think about it, but there's still like 8 out of 10. I'm still thinking about it. But it doesn't bother me enough to make a change. There's other pieces that I've had to like get rid of and change. Like Grant helped me rearrange the living room furniture. I rearranged where things were hung. I changed my towels and my sheets and my duvet. And like I made some big changes in the first 3 days, like a sweep, just to mix it up, you know? So there are some things that changed.
I have one more question.
Yeah.
And it's more what I pictured. You know, I told you I pictured you standing at that door.
Yeah.
And you were mentioning in the last episode that when you got to that door, you felt like a rope was pulling you out.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could go back to that moment where you were standing at that door.
Yeah.
And you felt that tug, would you
ignore it?
Ignore it.
I always rather know the truth.
Yeah.
And I don't want my life to be an illusion. I don't want my life to be false or fake or disingenuous. And I don't want that for my relationships. I don't want that for Reed. I want him to find a place where he has peace. I really do. I want the best for him. It's not that I'm not angry at what happened or how it all went, but sometimes I think I wish you would have just told me 4.5 years ago, I think now at this point, that this is something you wanted. So I would have had a choice to say that's not what I wanted. Because I think where I get really upset is I think, like, I feel like you robbed me of, you know, 3.5 years. You know? Nobody wants to be, like, ending a marriage at any age, I think, probably. But, and maybe this is just me romanticizing any other scenario but mine, but I think it would have been easier at 32 than 36. Or, like, and there's just context for being a woman who is interested in having her own kids that my timeline's different now. And that probably won't be my story. And I'm okay with that. Like, there's other stories, there's other ways to have family. But the way I thought it would happen will not happen. So yeah, I would still open the door and I would follow the tug because I'd rather experience pain and be honest than experience a placated version of my life and have it not be real. You know, I'd rather be alone than in a relationship where we're not really exchanging loving, selfless generosity. Because ultimately, like, what I want to do with my life is I want to give that to the people in my life. And I can't do that if I'm being, like, drained by something that's not real. So I would absolutely open the door.
It went off like a bang. Oh, everything that changed in that moment. Like a bang, blood coursed through my veins. Oh, oh, when those fatal words were spoken, that I was not your chosen, it went off like a bang. Explain what it feels like to lose. How do you explain what it feels like to lose the one you love? Oh, oh. When no words can be spoken to face what's been broken, how do you explain? Ooh, 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 ooh. Thank you. How do you explain?
Thanks to Michelle Sullivan and Sarah Snyder for being a part of this episode. Motor Spirit Podcast is hosted by Lativa Alatas, Aaron Hale, and me, Luke Bronner, and is a production of Milieu Media Group. This episode was produced and edited by me and mixed by the fine folks at Resonate Recordings. The artwork was designed by the amazing Annie Herzig, and all music from this and every episode is by Moda Spira. Be sure to support Moda Spira by following her on Spotify and purchasing her albums on iTunes or anywhere digital music is sold. For more information, including tour dates and news, visit modaspira.com. Please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review this show in Apple Podcasts, and be sure to share it with anyone who might need to hear it. Lastly, if you believe in the art of storytelling and want to partner in the production of more shows like this, as well as hear exclusive bonus content from this and other Milieu Media Group podcasts, visit the Patreon link in the show notes for this episode. Thanks so much for listening.